Future-Proof Extra from Newstalk.
Now, the world of tiny things goes far beyond the microscopic. At a certain point, things become so impossibly small that they simply can't be seen because they are smaller than the wavelength of visual light. You might expect that not much goes on down there, but you'd be very wrong. So what does this world look like? Well, it's a question Dr. Janet Iwasa has devoted herself to. She is assistant professor of biochemistry and head of the animation lab at the University of Utah. Welcome to the program, Janet. What do you do at an animation lab in a science world?
Yeah, so basically I have a group and we create visualizations of hypotheses. So basically how cell biologists, biochemists, molecular biologists think molecules work. We try to visualize those using animation.
Can you talk to us a little bit about this world, that the size of things and what things look like in general?
So most proteins are, like you said, smaller than the wavelength of light, visible light. So they can't directly be seen even with the best light microscopes. So these things are generally on the kind of nanometer or angstrom scale. And so this is 10 to the negative 9th to negative 10th meters. The way that we create these visualizations is by working with researchers who study these using different methods. And then we basically try to create these visualizations to bring these, their hypotheses to life.
So you create essentially animated films that look like, if people have seen Morph, if they remember that from when they were a kid, sort of animated putty stop motion graphic type films.
Yeah, I guess some people have described it like that. We actually use a digital software. So it's called Maya. There's any number of animation software that can be used to make molecular animations. But typically, we're importing data, so structural data, data that describes the way that molecules look as our models. So instead of animating, you know, fish and humans and stuff like that, we're animating these kind of blobby looking proteins.
When you say data that tells us how something might look, if you can't see it, how can you know what it looks like?
Yeah, so scientists, there's a whole field of biology called structural biology, where researchers are using different methods to understand the shape and size of molecules. So one way to do this is X-ray crystallography, where you crystallize a protein and use X-rays, which are smaller than the wavelength of visible light, to diffract them. And then from there, you can calculate the kind of the shape and size of molecules. And kind of more commonly now, people are also using cryo-electron microscopy to do this.
What is that?
So with cryo-electron microscopy,
it sounds so cool.
You use electron microscopy to take a look at basically frozen samples of proteins, and you take lots of images of them. And then they, you know, proteins may fall in different angles on a grid. And then once you have a lot of these images that are taken using electrons, then basically you can use a bunch of these images to classify them and then build a 3D kind of reconstruction of what the protein looks like.
And before we get into the animations, how do researchers go about isolating just the protein they're talking about? If you're talking about biological sample, at this level, you're talking about an incredible amount of resolution. How do they clean away the stuff that isn't protein to get a clear 3D picture of protein? Which, if I was to take your visualizations as a guide, look sort of like the colored pipe cleaners that we use, that sort of twisting around each other a lot of the time. How do you isolate what you want so that you can get that clean 3D tubey shape?
Yeah, so there are a lot of different methods of purifying proteins. So typically for cryo-electron microscopy, people are using purified samples, and also for X-ray crystallography. And so in this case, what they would often do is use some sort of like expression system, some cell that can overexpress the protein you're interested in. So that's one way where you just maybe you use bacteria and make them churn out this protein, and then you purify that away from all the other proteins using different methods. You may need to use mammalian cells. You may not want to do overexpression. So there are a lot of different ways of doing this, but basically the key is pulling them away somehow from all of the other proteins in the cell to get them into a relatively pure form before you put them through the whatever process you're going to use.
And the key word here is animation, because when we think of something like protein, we imagine that to be an inert thing, but they are anything but. At this microscopic level, there's a lot going on. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the proteins that you see, maybe what they look like and how they move?
Yeah, so the way that biologists usually envision the kind of the inside of the cell is this sort of massive jiggling mass of proteins that are all wiggling around and still managing to find each other through this crowded and very chaotic sort of mess.
It's like a mosh pit or something.
It is, yes. It's kind of like a mosh pit. So it's kind of amazing that anything actually happens correctly, yet it does. So I think that's the way we envision it, that they're always breathing and moving and things like that. But a lot of our data doesn't really tell that story. So the crystallography and EM, they kind of give a frozen snapshot of what a protein looks like. But we know from other types of experiments that they're moving around. So light microscopy, you can put a fluorescent protein a fluorescent protein on the protein you're interested in studying and watch it move around in a cell. So we know that they're constantly moving around and jiggling around. And from biochemistry experiments, we know that proteins can interact with each other in different ways and where they interact with each other. And so the animation is really trying to capture a lot of these dynamics that we see sort of indirectly from experiments.
If I didn't know that these animations were made from data, I would think that you're extrapolating or that you're anthropomorphizing like Disney or Pixar does with the angle poise lamp, you know, because when you look at these proteins, that some of them really look like they are crawling, climbing, hugging, holding hands and walking together. It's not something you would imagine a sort of an inert thing like a protein to be able to do. How does this motion happen? Maybe you might talk about the obvious one, motor proteins. How do they walk the way they do? But by the way, before we hear Janice answer, you can see videos of these on our Twitter page. It's twitter.com/newstalkscience. It'll give you an idea of the sort of animations we're talking about.
Yeah, so microtubule motor proteins are an interesting class because I think they really are difficult not to think of them as sort of walking things. And usually when people talk about them, you know, it's hard not to think the part that touches the microtubule are kind of like feet, and the part that like grabs onto cargos and moves them around are kind of like hands or arms or something like that. And they kind of look tall. You know, they're not kind of little, they're less kind of like spherical type things. They kind of have legs.
They look like people carrying things, walking along the tube.
Yeah. And you know, some classes of proteins look kind of more like a chariot of horses, and others look kind of more humanoid. But the way that the dynamics are figured out or are hypothesized, sometimes you get classes of different structures. So structures of proteins where you get a class where you have one kind of what we call a conformation. So where one part of like a leg is sticking out in one direction and another one where a leg is sticking out in a different direction. And from these different classes, you can start to think, how do we string this all together to make sense? That, and we have other types of data that can describe very small motions. So people use a lot of those kinds of data to kind of sort of extrapolate how they think a molecule might be working, how fast it walks, things like that, to really piece it together. So kind of combining the biochemistry data with structural data to kind of build this kind of a movie.
What is it about the protein that makes it move in that way? Is it a chemical interactions? Is it physical bonds changing? Is it changes in electrical charge?
It can be all of those things. The way that we think about proteins are kind of a long chain of amino acids that adopt a specific conformation. They fold in a specific way due to their charges. So there's 20 different amino acids, and each of them have different characteristics. Some of them might be sort of water loving, some of them might be kind of fat loving, some of them might be positively charged or negatively charged. And so depending on, you know, what your string of amino acids are, they may fold in a specific shape. And some of those amino acids are exposed to the solution and some of them are buried inside. And depending on that determines what other things they like to attach to. Microtubules have a specific charge. They're kind of positively charged. So the parts of motor proteins that like to bind may be, you know, the opposite charge. They may want to, you know, kind of pack into a specific little crevice. So it's kind of a random walk is the way people think about it. So it's kind of, you find the place that fits the best and you stay there for a specific kind of a random amount of time, not completely random, but, and then it may catalyze a reaction. So that's the way it's thought to happen is basically, a lot of the times the animation shows it kind of happening a lot more cleanly and nicely than it probably does in nature, because we're trying to tell a story. But in actuality, there's a lot of like Brownian motion and shaking and kind of like randomness that's happening at the molecular scale that we often don't really show, and we're, you know, not always sure how to show it.
It is uncanny looking at it. It does look as if there is some conscious work going on. If people look at the videos on Twitter, twitter.com/newstalkscience, it's very difficult not to think of this as a conscious organism doing something. But of course, that's not what we're looking at. What about DNA then? What can we see about DNA and how it replicates? And is that something you've looked at?
Yeah, so we've animated a bit of things with DNA, transcription and a little bit of replication, CRISPR, things like that.
And what do we learn from animating it?
So with DNA in particular, so we've, one of the animation projects I've worked on is proteins known as chromatin remodelers. So they kind of take DNA and they kind of move it along. So DNA is wrapped around these proteins known as histones, and they have to get basically scoot around the histones in order to get turned on, for genes to get turned on, because they can't, the DNA machinery that makes the RNA can't go through histones. And so the DNA has to get scooted around. So I think, you know, a lot of the process of animating these things, I think in general, kind of makes people think a little differently about how these processes work. So it's not usually that watching an animation all of a sudden gives people new insights or comes up, people come up with new experiments necessarily. It's often the process of creating the animation. So, I have to ask a lot of questions and really understand a process pretty deeply in order to create an animation. And so this process of asking questions and creating storyboard, that often makes the researchers start to think a little differently about the process and ask questions they may not have if they weren't trying to work on this 3D visualization that really forces them to ask themselves new things.
I'm surprised to hear you say that, because we know that visualization of data can often really help understand. I don't know if you're being modest or that hasn't happened yet, but surely looking at something in 3D in color and seeing what the motion looks like according to the data must yield some change of thinking, some discovery at some point.
It's often, I think what you get is that people may have thought that they thought a process occurred in the same way. So, you know, there are a lot of different people in the fields of, you know, chromatin remodeling or endocytosis. And people all, you know, read different papers and do different experiments. And the way I think of it is that people have this movie in their heads of their hypothesis of how things work. And you may just assume that everyone has the same hypothesis. There's some consensus idea and everyone agrees. And I think what animations often bring out is that there's no consensus, that people often disagree, especially when it comes to the more the smaller things, the kind of more detailed things. And that often comes out really clearly with an animation. When somebody sees an animation that doesn't match the kind of movie playing in their head, all of a sudden they have this tool to kind of better understand how someone else thinks about it and to say, you know, this part right here, you know, what is that based on? And how did you get that? Why do you think it happens like that? Because I thought it happened this way. So that's the kind of insights is more that it is able to kind of trigger these conversations that may not have happened otherwise. And that can lead to new ideas and new experiments.
How long does it take to make one of these movies when someone dumps a bunch of data on your desk?
So it depends a little bit. Some of our projects are multi-year projects. Some of them are just for a few months. So it really kind of depends on the collaboration and sort of the scale of the animation. But yeah, I'd say typically kind of minimally a few months and up to, you know, some of the projects like HIV we've been working on for years.
I presume you're also working on coronavirus because everybody's working on coronavirus, right?
We do have a coronavirus project. Yeah, so we're animating the life cycle. So yeah, that's just gotten launched and we're hoping to release new animations within, you know, the next few months to a year.
What's the most surprising thing that you've seen from your work? Is there a particular molecule or mechanism that when you saw the final animation, it really looked beautiful or surprising or gave you some thought? Is there one that jumps out?
You know, I think there are, you know, Clathrin is beautiful. It's kind of these geodesic dome looking things. And I guess, yeah, there are a lot of proteins that are just sort of beautiful when you watch them. So one class of proteins are known as AAA ATPases. They're usually a six protein ring that kind of moves around in circles and rips apart other proteins. And it's just kind of a fascinating thing to watch. And I think the first time I watched a movie and you know, worked on an animation, you just can't stop staring at it because it's just kind of amazing that these types of proteins exist in nature. And there are a lot of them and they're all like slightly different. And some of them are just really interesting to watch. But things like Clathrin, they have a beautiful symmetry. Things like viruses also do as well. And so I think there is a lot of beauty that you can see in the molecular world.
Can every lab afford this, or is it an expensive route to go down? Would you only do it for a particular reason?
Well, so the way it typically works is our group, we get grants like any other research lab. And so we're dependent on, and we're a nonprofit like all labs. We're not, you know, we're not a business. We're just trying to basically pay for our salaries and what are their, you know, computational costs. And so usually the way we work is that we will write grants and we will also collaborate on grants. And we've worked on a really wide variety of animations. Plants, I worked on the origins of life. So really like a really wide number of things outside of, you know, the kind of the typical kind of molecules and proteins that we work on. Yeah. So.
Well, as I say, if you want to see some of this amazing work, you can do so on our Twitter page. It's at @NewsTalkScience. Dr. Janet Iwasa from the University of Utah. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.